My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. Firstly, I hope all our American listeners have had a fantastic Thanksgiving with your loved ones. I trust you put all your leftovers outside for Bigfoot to enjoy as usual. This week, we take a trip to Asia to discuss a couple of the most well-known cryptids we've yet to cover, the Orang Pendek and the Yeti. Joining me once again to cover these wonderful creatures is world-famous cryptozoologist Richard Freeman. Richard returns to the show to discuss both creatures, on which he has been on expeditions to attempt to prove their existence, and we cover Richard's first-hand accounts from our witnesses in both Sumatra and Nepal, and also when he was stalked by a tiger. We also touch on the stories of the Vietnamese rock apes, monstrous snakes, man-eating crocodiles, yowies, lake monsters, and Richard's upcoming plans for next year. Before we join Richard, don't forget you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and subscribe to the channel on YouTube. You can also support us on Patreon for $1 a month. And please leave us a nice review on your podcast app to help the show grow and find more listeners just like you. You can always drop us a line too at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com with any guest suggestions or if you want to hear a certain show. Now, Richard Freeman talks hominids. This week, we are delighted to welcome back British cryptozoologist, researcher, investigator and author, Richard Freeman. Richard has a vast experience of investigations around the world, most notably searching for both the thylacine and the Orang Pendek of Sumatra. It is this creature that many in the cryptid field feel is possibly the closest to being discovered since stories first appeared over 100 years ago. This is not to say that people believe this animal is an undiscovered hominid, but more likely to be a member of the ape family, possibly related to the orangutan, that has avoided detection due to the inaccessibility of the area it is most notably seen in. Richard, welcome back to the show. How are we?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for having me back. Nice to be here.
Hey, you're very welcome. So as we've discussed occasionally online, as we chat now and again, the Orang Pendek is probably one of the most requested subjects I've had since I started the show, primarily because I think it's seen as scientifically one of the most valid cryptids, if you can use that term, that's out there. So what was it that drew your attention to it first of all, Richard? Because you've kind of spent the best part of 20 years out and about and over in Sumatra looking for this creature.
Well, initially, it was another member of the CFZ, a guy called Dr. Chris Clark. He came up with this idea of going to Sumatra to look for the Orang Pendek way back in 2003. And myself and another guy called John Hare joined him. And we found that the evidence was so compelling that we've been going back ever since, every few years. I mean, along with the Tasmanian wolf, I think this is the cryptid most likely to exist, and it may only be a hair's breadth away from being discovered.
Mm. I mean, it's intriguing. It's the one that I've come across. I've seen notable documentaries about it, most notably from the British Centre for Fortean Zoology, starring your good self. But I think the show that really caught my attention about the Orang Pendek, other than the articles I'd seen in the Fortean Times, was the episode of Monster Quest, when they went out there as that, I think they call it the real Hobbit, because it was a bit of a strange mishmash of ideas. But that featured most notably an interview with a lady called Debbie Marter, which when I heard her speak, it absolutely blew me away, because she was under no illusion of what she'd seen.
No. Debbie Marter began as a travel journalist. And she's from Britain, and she was over in Sumatra, and she'd heard these stories of the Orang Pendek and just thought it was folklore. Mm. And she was talking to one guide and chatting what was living in the jungles of this certain part of Sumatra, and like, they said rhinos, elephants, tigers, the Orang Pendek, but are seldom seen, it's very rare. And she said, "What do you mean the Orang Pendek? Isn't that just folklore?" And they said, no, it really existed. And about a month after this conversation, she was in the jungle when she heard all the fireman gibbons calling as if something had disturbed them. And the guide said he would go around and try and flush whatever it was out into a clearing by making some noise. And she, he in the bushes, and pardon me, the guide went to flush whatever the animal was out. Mm. And she was expecting to see something like a sun bear. And instead, what walked into the clearing, she said, was a relatively short but powerfully built ape that was walking upright like a man, not on all fours, not knuckle walking, and not the awkward gait of an orangutan when it's on the floor, but something that was walking smoothly and naturally upright. And since then, she'd seen it several times again. And now she stayed in Indonesia, and she's now at the head of the Indonesian Tiger Conservation Group. Mm. But she's had multiple sightings. She's had about, I think, four sightings, two of them fairly close, others a bit further off in the jungle.
The key parallel here, I think, Richard, is not necessarily a direct parallel, of course, but do you think that science has taken the Orang Pendek more seriously because of the discovery of Homo floresiensis?
I think it was, of all of the mystery primates, it's the one that's been taken most serious. Mm. And before that, it was looked on more kindly than, shall we say, things like Bigfoot. I think it's the area in which it lives. Mm. That where we go, Kerinci Sablat National Park, is, you know, the size of a small country, it's the size of Wales. Mm. Dense jungle, dense mountain jungle, cloud forest, where something like that could really exist. Now, Homo floresiensis, when it was initially found, it was thought only to be about 12,000 years old, but they've found now that it's about 50,000 years old. Mm. But the fossils were in exquisite condition. And it was thought initially to be a dwarf island form of Homo erectus. Hmm. But more recently, Australian paleontologists have looked at it, and they say that it's much more closely related to another hominin, another African hominin called Homo habilis. Hmm. Now, since that time, there have been other fossil hominins in the Homo habilis lineage that have been discovered. Yeah. Homo luzonensis has just been discovered in the Philippines, yeah, which seems to have been very similar to Homo floresiensis. And there are two unnamed species from Red Deer Cave in China that also seem to have an affinity with Homo habilis. And these haven't been given a name yet, but they apparently were only 10,000 years old, which was the blink of an eye in evolutionary terms, yeah, these two from China. Which means that Homo habilis, also left Africa and had its own lineage right the way, halfway around the world, which begs the question, you know, what other descendants and relatives did it have, and what else was or is out there? Mm. The Orang Pendek itself is unlikely to be closely related to it, though. The structure of the foot, and I've seen and cast footprints of this thing and handprints, is not that of a hominin, it's that of an ape. It has a broad heel, very human-like, four toes at the front, and then an offset semi-prehensile big toe. So its foot structure is not like that of an orangutan. And its handprints, which I've seen many of, and cast as well, they're not like an orangutan. The orangutan has a very short thumb, very long, thin fingers. They're arboreal. They spend almost all their time in the trees. And their hands and feet are very different from the orang pendek. The orang pendek's hand looks like that of a small gorilla more than anything else. And the description of it is very much a pongid rather than a hominin. We got hair from this creature, and it was examined by Lars Thomas from Copenhagen University. It was found, this hair, next to footprints and handprints. And he examined this hair, and he said it is something that's related to, but distinct from, the Sumatran orangutan. And that he's forced to conclude that there's a large unknown primate in Sumatra. Now, only 3 years ago, the Tapanuli orangutan was discovered in Sumatra, a whole new species of orangutan that's different from both the Bornean orangutan and the Sumatran orangutan. And that was completely unknown until, you know, a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And there's only about 700 of them left, and the Chinese are thinking of building a hydroelectric scheme straight through their habitat. Now, if a third species of an orangutan can exist, what's stopping a fourth species, perhaps adapted to a terrestrial ground-dwelling existence, being out there as well? And that's what I think orang pendek is. It's the fourth extant species of orangutan, but this one, it has much darker fur, it lives on the forest floor, and it walks upright like a man.
I mean, it is unusual as well, because I know those that poo-poo this kind of these theories and eyewitness reports, Richard, will always say, oh, well, these people, yeah, you know, these simple native people, they're just misunderstanding. It's an orangutan, even though the colour doesn't match straight away, and it doesn't look like an orangutan. But the most striking thing is it seems to have a more sort of human kind of behaviour, because I know a lot of the early witnesses from sort of the 1920s, when the stories were first being collected, would say they would see it on the edge of farmland near forest edges.
Oh, yes, yeah. You know, orangutans are arboreal. They spend almost all their time in the tree, so they very rarely come down. When they do, they move around on all fours, except for the male Sumatran orangutan, which walks upright. But it has this very bizarre gait, because it walks on the edges of its feet, and it's got these great long arms which it lifts up, and it has this odd sort of clumsy, waddling gait, totally unlike the orang pendek. Now, the orang pendek is most often seen not in deep jungle, but in this area called the Garden, which is a sort of semi-cultivated area between cultivated land and the jungle proper. And that's not surprising, because it's coming in there to exploit human food sources. And we've had, you know, a number of reports, one of them of one smashing its way into a shed to steal sugar cane, and they'll come and dig up potatoes and fruit and stuff as well. But most of them are in this semi-cultivated area.
Yeah, and the other thing that struck me as well is that you know when we talk about other mystery hominids around the world, there are often eyewitnesses that see them carrying dead animals of some description. But the orang pendek seems quite unique in the fact that it tends to be seen to be stealing vegetation above anything else. I can't think of a witness report that refers to seeing it with any kind of dead animal as a food source, Richard.
Well, there are reports of them tearing into rotting logs to get insect larvae.
Quite
a few reports of that. And the most footprints and handprints I've seen are around dead trees and dead logs. When I was last there, we found masses of handprints and footprints around these areas. It has, there have been reports of it wading into water to get mollusks. and even using a stick to spear fish with. But we know that orangutans do that anyway. Orangutans have been seen doing that.
Yes.
Sharpening up a stick with their teeth and then using it as a spear. And there are some very old reports from the early part of the 20th century of them feeding on dead rhino that had been captured in pit traps, that fall into pit traps set by natives and died, and then they exploited the carrier. But the bulk of their diet is certainly vegetation.
Yeah. There are also, in many of the accounts, the witnesses are struck by how powerful their upper body seems to be, Richard, which is also quite distinct in regards to the normal animals that are out there as well. That's something else that kind of separates it.
Yes, they're about the size of a large male chimpanzee, but upright, but the upper part of the body is very powerful. One witness we talked to, Mr. Pimper, who'd seen one walking through the rainforest, he said it reminded him of Mike Tyson. Its shoulders were so massive. our guide, the late Sahar Dimas, his father had seen one. And he said it was tossing logs around. It was at a place where someone was making a log cabin, and this thing had gone to the log pile and was heaving these logs around as if they were nothing. So it's immensely strong, hugely strong.
Absolutely. I mean,
not aggressive. Usually, it will try and get away from people. There are stories of it hurling sticks and things. But usually, it tries to try and move away from people.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is. I've seen a couple of stories where people have said it's sort of ripped saplings out of the ground and thrown them as a kind of scare tactic, you would suggest.
Yeah, well, lots of apes do that. Lots of apes will rip up vegetation and shake vegetation. There was one story we heard about a poacher who trapped one in a snare, and he tried to prod at it with his spear, and it smashed the spear and roared at him. And it scared him so much he fainted, and by the time he got up, it freed itself from the snare and cleared off.
Goodness me, I've never heard that. God, I mean, that's something as well, because, you know, this is the other aspect of this area, Richard, is it's the jungle is a dangerous place in Sumatra. I mean, you know, with the greatest respect, you've got tigers there.
I've been stalked by tiger. Last time I was there, we generally concentrate on an area called Gunung Tuju, the Lake of Seven Peaks, which is a lake in the caldera of an extinct volcano. It's up in the mountains. It gets very cold at night. It's a very damp jungle. And there's only really one place to camp around there. There's a small beach where you can camp. And the rest, the jungle goes straight up to the water. And we had a big tent there, and we'd lit a fire. And it was on the last night of my last expedition. And there's a little narrow path that leads off into the jungle. And that night, I had the creepiest feeling of being watched. All the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. And I knew that there was something watching us from along that trail into the jungle. I knew there was something there. And I mentioned this to the others on the expedition. And then in the morning, when we were breaking camp, I went along this little trail with one of the natives. And we saw fresh tiger tracks. They hadn't been there the day before, and the tiger had come down that night and followed us down to the camp, but had stopped when it seen the fire. The fire is what stopped it coming into the camp.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's both terrifying and incredibly exhilarating as well.
It was, yes. And our guide is sadly now dead. He was a tiger shaman for his tribe. They have a sacred animal. Each tribe has a sacred animal, and his tribe, they call them Nanaks, and the Nanak of this tribe was the tiger. And it was sacred to them, and he believed he could bring down the spirit of the tiger and go into a trance and bring the spirit of the tiger into him. But the thing about the Orang Pendeki is it has no spiritual connotations for the people. It's just another animal. Now, the tiger that does exist, we know it exists, that has spiritual connotations. They'll tell all sorts of tales about the tiger. You're not supposed to go naked in the jungle because it will anger the tiger. And if you're cooking rice in a pot, you never take the rice straight from the pot. You ladle it out. You don't take it out with your hands, because that will anger the tiger. And there's all sorts of all sorts of protocol you have to have in the jungle as not to anger the tiger. But the Orang Pendek was nothing like that about the Orang Pendek. No spiritual belief attached to it at all.
Which, to be fair then, Richard, would kind of give credence to the fact that as far as the peoples of the area are concerned, it's what another species of person, another type of ape. As far as they're concerned, it's a real thing.
They look on it as an ape. They look on it as an animal, an ape.
Mm.
There was one person who saw one in an old graveyard once. There was an old graveyard in the jungle. I mean, it's been built over now, and that part of the jungle has been cut down. This was years ago. And he saw one stand up from behind a gravestone. And at first he thought it was a ghost. They call them Hantu, I think, ghosts in the local language. He thought it was a ghost. And then he realised it was an animal. It was the Orang Pendek. But at first, when he saw it stand up from behind a gravestone, he thought it was a ghost.
I mean, when was the last time you were out there, Richard? How long ago was your last expedition?
Oh, that would have been about 2015, I think, if memory serves.
Mm.
Around about then, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the other both intriguing and frustrating aspects of the Orang Pendek is that we've had two outstanding wildlife photographers. Both have encounters where they've clearly seen the creature, and on both occasions both were just simply frozen and couldn't react.
Yeah, because they were both gobsmacked. Jeremy Holden saw it.
Yes.
He's a first-rate wildlife photographer.
Yeah, well, Jeremy did a lot of work with Debbie Marta, didn't he?
He did, yes. Yeah, he did, yeah.
Anyway, sorry, Richard, carry on.
He saw it himself, and he thought... I mean, and my friend Dave Archer, on one of the expeditions, his first day in the jungle, he was out, and the team split up. There was myself and Chris Clark went, and some of the guides went one way. Adam Davis, who's a mate of mine, and... Dave Archer and Sahar, the other guy, went another way. And once again, they heard the sea man gibbons, the calling, as if there was something upsetting them.
Mm.
And Dave, Adam didn't see it, but Dave, who was further ahead, saw it. He saw the Orang Pendek clinging to a tree, and he described it as being the size of a big chimpanzee, very broad shouldered, blonde, shaggy hair. It was very black hair. It was very similar to a mountain gorilla, which makes sense when you think about the climate, because they're both living in cloud forest.
Mm.
And he said it had a very strikingly human-looking face with a swept-back hair and a high forehead.
Mm.
And he said he saw it climb down from the tree and walk away on two legs. Now, our guide, Sahar, had been in the jungle, living in the jungle for 14 years, and he'd seen tigers, elephants, all sorts of things. That was the first time he'd ever seen the Orang Pendek. And he actually wept because he had never seen this animal before.
I mean, it must. I mean, it's one of those things as well, Richard. I think it's one of those creatures where there are certain... When you hear certain witnesses and you listen to them and the way they talk about it, there are certain cases, whether it's Bigfoot or the Yowie or the Yeti or the Orang Pendek, there is always the stories that and accounts that seem to me to be more believable are the ones where there seems to be a real emotional reaction from the person, say, you know, describing what they saw and their experience. It's as though it's changed them.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. The last time I was there, we got together. There must have been about 30 people. We got 30 witnesses together, and they'd come from all over the area to this particular village to talk to us.
Mm.
I mean, they were not getting any reward for this. They were just wanting to tell their story. And some had just seen the footprints, but quite a few of them had seen the creature. And they were all just describing this barrel-chested, short, dark fur, generally dark grey or black fur, this creature with a very human-looking face. And most of them were very alarmed when they'd seen it, because, you know, they were not expecting to stumble on something like this. all of their stories dovetailed, and there was no exaggeration in any of it. And these people don't really have a reason to lie.
Yeah.
I mean, it always annoys me how sort of Western skeptics will always think that naked people will lie and they'll just tell you what you want to know because they want to get something.
Yes.
I mean, I've only ever come across that once, and that was in West Africa.
Mm.
In all my travels, I've only ever come across it once. And most of the people have nothing to gain by lying.
Yeah.
And they don't attach any spiritual significance to the creature.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
skeptics.
Go on, Richard.
Just sitting there. They'll just sit at their desks and in front of their laptops and spout absolute drivel without ever going to these places and looking for themselves. And they'll cherry pick things as well to support their cult, as it were. Because I think skepticism is very like a religious cult.
Mm. Yeah.
It's a system of belief.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting how you say
that. To me, the thing...
Go on, Richard.
It's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of evidence. And when I look at all these sightings, when I look at tracks, and I've worked with great apes. I've worked closely with all the known great apes. I know what their tracks look like.
Mm.
I know what the tracks of a sun bear looks like, and a tapir, and all the other ones. When I see these tracks and handprints of something under, I know is unknown to science. When we get the hair that is examined and it's shown to be from an unknown primate.
Mm.
And all these witnesses, it's simpler that there's an unknown primate.
Yeah.
If you use Occam's razor, it's simpler that it's an unknown primate. And Adam Davies got some hair as well.
Yeah.
And it was examined by a gentleman in Australia, another expert in mammal hair.
Yeah.
His name completely escapes me now, but he was the guy the police consulted on the dingo baby case, where the poor woman was locked up for murdering her baby, and it's actually a dingo that took the baby.
Yes.
Azalea, the baby was called. Yes, yes. If you remember the case.
Oh,
yeah.
It's legend of the film as well.
Yeah, he looked at the hair that Adam got, and he said, this is a new primate. It's a primate. He came to much the same conclusion as Lars Thomas. They prepared a paper between them for the magazine Nature.
Mm.
And the editor of Nature said, I really wanted to put this in, but it's been vetoed by other people because it's too controversial because this is a large animal. If it had been a new species of mouse, there would have been no problem.
Mm.
Now, what an insane way for science to work. That's like fundamentalist religion. That makes no logical sense whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, you get that in certain aspects of science. I remember the other year, Richard, I heard a physicist talking about the possibility of aliens and life on other planets, and he just basically said, well, we've discovered everything we need to know. And I was just like, how can you have that attitude as a scientist? Your job is to smash that barrier down. You know, that's what Einstein did. This is that the fundamental principles of science are built on proving people wrong, are they not?
Yeah, and like, a theoretical physicist, right, can write a scientific paper on a particle that no one has ever seen. It's just inferred from the behaviours of the particles around it.
Mm.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
If a zoologist writes a paper on a new species of animal that thousands of people have seen, but we haven't got a type specimen yet, then he's the heretic.
Yeah.
He's the pariah. He's the madman.
Yeah,
That's not the way science should work.
No, burn the witch.
And the example I always use is a French biologist called Pierre-Denis de Montfort, who was active mainly during the late part of the 18th century. And he was an expert in mollusks, and he was attached to the Natural History Museum in Paris and the Botanical Gardens in Paris. And he wrote many books on mollusks, and he was sent on expeditions as far afield as Egypt, which, you know, back then was quite an undertaking. And he was like one of the most celebrated biologists in Europe, this guy, Pierre-Denis de Montfort. And then he got talking to whalers from Nantucket who had settled in Paris, and they told him stories about sucker marks being found on sperm whales and dying sperm whales vomiting up these huge tentacles. And he looked into this And he talked to other captains who said that their boats had been attacked by enormous squid. And he came to the conclusion that the Kraken of Norse mythology was based on a huge species of squid unknown to science. And because he postulated this, he became a scientific pariah.
Yeah.
He lost his position, lost his job. It ended up selling seashells, collecting seashells and selling them for a pittance, and died of starvation in a Parisian gutter in 1820.
Oof.
Now, a few decades later, I think it was 1857, the first giant squid was captured. He was right all along, but he's been forgotten by history. And, you know, his name is just lost to the ages. And he was the guy, I call him the prophet of the Kraken, because he prophesied the existence of the giant squid. And he, his name really needs to be rehabilitated, and he needs the recognition. The recognition, you know, that he deserves.
Yeah, I mean,
rather
it is,
than being either forgotten or thought of as a madman.
It is. It is interesting, like you say, Richard, that these kind of things occur. Because I mean, I was channel hopping on Saturday night and came across the new series of Extinct or Alive with Forrest Gallant, whose grandfather famously was the first Western scientist to catalogue the the fish found off the coast of Madagascar. Coelacanth.
Coelacanth.
Hey, dearie me, I'll be having words with my brain later for forgetting that fact. It was the one where they went to the Galapagos Islands, and he literally, within about a day of being there, rediscovered this tortoise that had only ever once been seen 112 years ago. And he found it. Boom. There it is.
Yeah,
enormous. Absolutely enormous.
This is an iguana. As well, we just found a new species of iguana over there, a great big thing about a metre long.
We had the deer last week as well, that deer that was extinct 30 years ago. It's been rediscovered in rude health.
Oh, the little chevrotain,
Beautiful, beautiful. And it's got little fangs as well, which made me chuckle. Such a cute yet vicious-looking creature.
I would think about the Tasmanian wolf. I've been over there, you know, I've been over there three times now looking at a Tasmanian wolf, and I've spoken to a government licensed shooter who goes out killing the feral cats. He's seen it twice. An old egg flogger who saw it in the 50s, and his son had seen it just a year before. A guy that running an arboretum who'd seen it with his wife in a car, and there was another car that stopped and saw the thing as well. And the whole of the west side of the island is virtual wilderness. Tasmania itself is about the size of Ireland. And the whole of the west side of it is forests and mountains. And when you get a village, they're tiny. They're more like hamlets. The towns are like villages. And there's only two big cities, Launceston and Hobart. And, you know, they're like a very small British city. There's less than 500,000 people who live in Tasmania. And does the continued existence of the Tasmanian wolf has also been predicted by a computer program. Professor Henry Nix wrote a computer program called BioClin. I think he's attached to Melbourne University, if memory serves. And it was a research tool wherein you program in everything that is known about a target species, then everything that is known about a geographical area, and it will match up to see where in this geographical area your target species is most likely to be found. And then he did that with a psilocybin, and he found that something like 97 reports of the Tasmanian wolf in the modern day in Tasmania matched up with where the BioClim program was predicting it should live if it was still alive. Now, the computer program doesn't care about anything.
No.
The computer program doesn't lie. It just does what it's supposed to do.
Ah, but does it give the right result, Richard? That's the question. Clearly not. For some. Yeah, I mean, that's a whole new... I mean, I've been very lucky to speak to several notable Australian cryptozoologists so far. And it's been a pleasure learning a lot more about the country, but it amazes me, Richard. I think a lot of people don't appreciate firstly, how big and remote Australia is. And the same goes for Tasmania, like you say, because, you know, people see, I'm not really sure what people's perception of Australia is, because they don't seem to understand anything about 2,000 miles of nothing in the middle of it.
Yeah, we've got most of the big cities in Australia, they're around the coast.
Yeah, absolutely.
You go inland, there's nothing. You've got the Blue Mountains, the wilderness there, you've got the Central Desert.
Yeah, Northern Territory.
North, you've got the swamps.
Yeah. It's mystifying. But, I mean, that in itself, you know, that's one of the things that I give the Yowie a lot of credence in regards to that, because of the remoteness of Australia in comparison to the size of the place and the population. And it's the same with Tasmania. I mean, they called it Van Diemen's Land for a reason. go on, Richard, after you, sir.
Up in New Guinea as well, there are reports of this thing. They call it the Dobsonga. The hill tribes, they say it looks like a dog with stripes down its back and a stiff tail, and it's got these great jaws that open wide, and it comes down and kills their livestock. And they won't hunt it because they think it's taboo to hunt them.
Yeah.
And that's a perfect description of the Tasmanian wolf.
Yeah.
And we know from a fossil record that it lived in New Guinea.
Yeah. It is. I mean, it's very interesting. I think that whole area of Eastern Asia is ripe for exploration, especially in the modern era, Richard, because I think it's kind of just been, I think people kind of left it sort of post Second World War, you know, God forbid some of the atrocities that were carried out across the Pacific on, you know, in the name of the movement of the Japanese nation and terrifying, it seemed to touch every island across that whole continent, sadly. But it leads me towards another intriguing cryptid, which has always mystified me, which is the rock ape of Vietnam, primarily because it's just a very odd story that seems to parallel a lot of hominid stories from other parts of the world.
Yes, it does. Now, most of these reports were from American GIs who were, you know, fighting for their life in jungles. These were young men with no experience who were terrified. They've got better things to do, like clinging on to life, than making up daft stories.
Yeah.
And these things, what they call them rock apes, because they said oftentimes they'd hurl rocks at the GIs. And they seemed to range in size from about 5 feet up to 7 feet. And they had this mainly ginger, but sometimes dark fur. And the witnesses said that, they looked like orangutans, but they were upright, and they moved like men, upright on their hind legs.
I think the thing that's always made me chuckle about this as well is that on first sort of witness sightings on both sides, they assumed it was the other side mucking about or trying to frighten them.
I mean, both sides saw it. The Viet Cong saw it as well.
Yeah, because I think that's where the original, where it started to be taken slightly more seriously than you know, like a tall tale from a, like you say. I mean, if anybody doesn't know just how, you know, tough it was for soldiers in the Vietnam War, I suggest anybody watch a couple of documentaries that don't hold any punches, because it was an absolutely brutal place to be, a terrifying situation for any young man.
I wouldn't want to be in any war.
Want
to be in any war, but the two that make my blood run cold are World War One in the trenches and Vietnam.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a guy called Greg T.J. Jorgensen who was over there, and he said that in one case there was a patrol in 1969. He was witness to that. It was caught off guard by enemy fire, and the men all sort of hit the deck and lay in the vegetation, and they heard the sound of something approaching. At first, they thought it was one of the Viet Cong It looked like a man when it came into view. And then they saw it was this muscular, 7-foot-tall, ape-like creature covered in reddish hair. And it moved fast through the jungle. It got winged by the crossfire and it stumbled, but then it went on again. And they were so frightened that they fled, and leaving their guns. So to leave the guns, they must have been, you know, really frightened. And then they said, when they moved into a more secure area, and that night they were terrified by this screaming noise in the jungle. And when they investigated the next day, they found a member of the Viet Cong who'd been torn apart by some kind of an animal. So whether that was the same creature or not, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting as well, because often people... The thing about this is as well, Richard, it's quite interesting, because the American witnesses don't describe it as, oh, it's a Bigfoot. They call this an ape, which may, you know...
Yeah,
that's,
a rock ape.
Yeah, that... Because of course, let's not forget, the Vietnam War was, what, 65 to 74, 75, I think they finally called it quits. God knows what the reasons were for 10 years waste, you know, so much life wasted across all sides. But it just seems to be unusual, because obviously during that period you had the explosion of Bigfoot in America. So a sceptical view would say, well, surely they were just saying, oh, well, we've seen the Bigfoot. But nobody uses that term in any of the reports I've looked at that have come out about it, Richard. Nobody uses the term an Asian Bigfoot, other than sort of modern retellings of the story. It's not in the witness accounts. They call it an ape. Which I think just gives it a bit more credence, because, and especially I think the Vietnamese had a name for it. Was it the Batutut or something like that? I think
that's one of the, that's what it's called, Malaya. In Vietnam, it's called the Ngung Roi, the forest man.
Yeah, yeah, forest person, isn't it, or some forest man or something? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an
intriguing.
Yeah,
I mean, there was a guy who was the ministry, worked for the as an agent of the Ministry of Propaganda back in the war, called Ngo Hoang, and then like in later days, he went and investigated this thing, this creature in the forest, and. On one of these trips, he says we were able to discover these forest men in about 1950, in an area in the vicinity of the Chubai mountain chain. And he said the footprint of the forest man leaves behind is about 1.5 times as big as that of a normal man. The big toe is slightly separated from the others. In the middle of the sole of the foot, there are many folds, which is a similar thing you do get with Bigfoot, the mid-tarsal break. And it says, after that, some of my comrades of a pioneer unit saw a big man covered entirely in grey hair. They thought it was an orangutan and wanted to kill him, but fortunately they had strict orders not to shoot. That's why this man could escape. My comrades told me that he could run very fast, fast as only a forage creature, but no man could run. So there were sightings on both sides, you see.
Yeah. The other thing as well, which I always found quite striking about these reports, Richard, is that in the majority of cases I've seen, the creature seems completely unfazed that it's run across a group of people. It doesn't react. You know, in the normal, we tend to, you know, Bigfoot tends to run off people.
Yeah.
Whenever we see hominids or whatever, I mean, there's a few occasions where yowies have gone, all right, I'm going to scare you half to death here. But these guys in the Vietnam area seem like, well, here I am. What do you think to that?
Yeah, bang rocks. Some of them, there was one case when there was a whole group of them. There was a larger black one and some smaller ginger colored ones. It was like a whole tribe of them who were coming out and whipping rocks at the GIs.
I mean, it's bad enough dealing with the war going on without that, stumbling across that, Richard, I would suggest.
Yeah.
I mean...
And we've got to remember as well, now we're getting fossil and DNA stuff that's backing this up. Because in recent years, not only have we had Homo floresiensis, and now the Homo luzonensis from the Philippines, and these new ones from China, and the Siberian species, the Denisovans,
Denisovans, or however you like to call it, yes.
which were much bigger than we thought. They're only known from toe bones and finger bones. Now they found a jaw. They're much bigger than Homo erectus, these things.
In
They found a
Nepal as well,
jaw
Richard, haven't they?
in Nepal. And we've also got genetic evidence when they've looked at groups of people. And we've got something like 4% Neanderthal in us. All people, all non-black Africans, have got at least 4% Neanderthal in us. The Denisovans have also added to certain populations as well. But there are other populations, particularly around New Guinea and that sort of area, that seems to have other markers, genetic markers on them, and the inference is that they come from other, as yet undiscovered hominids. We haven't even got the bones of them yet. They've just left their genetic markers. So there's at least two of those. So we've got this sort of family tree that's becoming more like a tangled bush of these things. And I'd be amazed if some of these weren't surviving today. Indeed, the biologist Henry G said that if someday somebody brings evidence that one of these things is surviving into something like Sumatra or Vietnam, I would be delighted, but not in the least bit surprised.
I mean,
Now
we've. Go on, Richard.
we've got more evidence now that there was a guy called Mark Evans, and a couple of years ago he took a expedition to hunt for the Yeti
Yes.
in Bhutan, and they took samples of water from a lake in the mountains to look for eDNA, environmental DNA. And they found, amongst other things, a species of wild sheep that was unknown from the area at the time, but also the eDNA from a primate that shared 99% of its genetic makeup with human beings. So it's more closely related to a human than a chimpanzee is. Now, the French geneticist, Dr. Eva Bellemare, who worked on this, I contacted her, and she said she hasn't had the time and the money to follow this up. And the company she used to work for, she thinks they've still got the samples. I'm trying to get a guy called Tom Gilbert and his team from the University of Copenhagen interested in examining these. But it seems like whenever we get some evidence, the skeptics are always saying, oh, where's the evidence? Why don't you give us evidence? When we find evidence like this, which should have the scientific world on fire, no one's interested. It's left. Oh, we haven't got the time or the money to do this. It's just either disposed of or left somewhere, which is insanity.
It is. I mean, it seems to have, I seem to come across a story every sort of 2 months, Richard, where a new species of dinosaur's been discovered in a drawer. Because somebody's gone, oh yeah, it's just that, and they've just left it. And that, for me, it just astounds me that we can keep finding, we have evidence of species that are just stuffed away in drawers all around the world. It's mental.
Now, have you heard of the story of Zaina?
Is that the alleged Russian
Yeah.
who was held captive?
Yeah. Now, the story goes that about 1850, in an area of the Caucasus Mountains that's now in Georgia, an almasti, a female almasti, was captured. That's just the wild man of the Caucasus Mountains. And she was said to be black-skinned with reddish-black hair, 6 foot 9, long pendulous breasts, massively muscular, flat ape-like nose, thick brow ridge, big powerful jaws and teeth. And she was taken to a farm where she tamed down fairly quickly, but she would never speak. If they tried to keep her indoors, she just slept profusely. So they built a sort of stockade for her outside, which she slept in. And she would do menial tasks around the farm because she was so strong. She could carry bags of flour about and things like that. And she learned to grind corn. And weirdly, they say that in her spare time, she enjoyed banging rocks together. So whether that was flint knapping or something, God knows. But she was very fond of liquor, and if she got hold of booze, she'd just drink and drink and drink until she was unconscious. And in that state, several of the local men raped her. And she had a number of hybrid children. And the early ones she tried to wash in the river, and the shock killed them. So the later ones were taken off her and raised in the village. And apparently they looked pretty much like modern humans, but they were bigger, stronger, and swarthier. And the youngest son quit, and he died in 1953.
Yeah.
So, a guy called Igor Burtseff managed to get hold of Quit's skull by going and digging up the grave and getting hold of it. And it was in the Darwin Museum in Moscow. Sorry, I've got that the wrong way around. It was somebody else that dug it up initially.
Yes.
Someone dug up Quit's skull, and it was in the Darwin Museum in Moscow, and it was brought by Igor Burtsev eventually. He didn't find it initially. He brought it from the Darwin Museum. And it's within the parameters of a modern human being. It's got a slight brow ridge, and the jaw's very powerfully built. But it's within the parameters of a modern human being. But Professor Brian Sykes did some work on a couple of teeth that were sent to him. Now, Sykes had this thing where he was he perfected a new way of isolating DNA, and he was asking for hair from Bigfoot, Yeti, other creatures. He got a lot of hair, and it all turned out to be modern human or horse or bear or wolf or known species. But the teeth he got mitochondrial DNA from his teeth, and he said that it was definitely sub-Saharan African.
Yeah.
And he examined it some more, and he can read about this in his book, The Nature of the Beast. And I've written to him, and he's written back and told me about it. He reckons, and he's still working on the samples now, that the sub-Saharan African DNA was subhuman as well. It was pre-Homo sapiens. So this is some unknown species of hominid that had left Africa and was living in the Caucasus Mountains, and he reckons they're still there, whatever they are.
Yeah. I mean, it is, it's an intriguing story. It's probably one of the better hominid stories from the old Eastern Bloc, I think, as well, Richard, because it's like, as you say, that there was a living relative into fairly recent time. So luckily, because Sykes came across that as part, because he was part of the team with Mark Evans that did the Yeti test, wasn't it? Because he was looking for the samples in all three. I think they did one on the Yeti, one on Bigfoot. And did they do one on the Almasty sort of this Zaina as well, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, well, his book is about the upshot of that. And Mark Evans did that second expedition to Bhutan, and he was still very sceptical until they got this eDNA. But it never gets any further. It seems to never get any further.
Well, it's one of those things, because if you just, like, even if we've just spoken about, you know, we've touched on the two species that have been uncovered out in the Pacific, Fluorienses, and apologies for my pronunciation, Richard, you're probably much better than this than me, and Denisovians. But, you know, 25 years ago, the general train of scientific thought was Neanderthals died out because they weren't very clever. Now we know they crossbred.
Yeah, and they were incredibly successful and clever.
And essentially everything came together, didn't it? I mean, there were just lots of horny cave people running about, I think, going on this. Because I think it's survival of the fittest, isn't it, Richard? You do what you do in you know, obviously in some of the climatic extinction events that these species would have had to have gone through as well. It's intriguing. I mean, obviously, I think we've obviously mentioned it a couple of times, and I think it's only fair, because I've never really touched on one of the daddies of cryptozoology, really, which is of course the Yeti.
The Yeti.
I mean,
the greatest of all the mystery.
It's a wonderful
mystery.
I mean,
finite.
Yeah, I still remember the very first time I saw Eric Shipton's photo, and I must have been 8 or 9. And it just blew me away. It was just that whole series of tracks that they captured is just, I mean, it'll be nearly 70. Oh, it's 1951, I think it was, Richard. The world just went Yeti mad, didn't it?
Yeah. And I think probably they were the prints of something like a bear that had melted and refrozen. I think that I don't think they were genuine Yeti tracks. I think they were mistaken in that case. But that doesn't mean that the Yeti doesn't exist.
Mm.
And the reports of it going back centuries, and it's in the art of the local people. And the name Mito Kangme is a sign of Tibetan for abominable man of the rocks. And it was mistranslated as abominable man of the snows in a telegraph message. And that's where we get the false idea of the Yeti being white.
Mm,
the
yes.
Yeti is generally described as being black or brown, occasionally auburn. I think there's only two reports of white Yetis in like the whole of known literature about it. Mm. As far as I know, there's only two reports of a white Yeti. The Yeti is generally black. And the term Yeti actually is Tibetan for rock beast. I think, but the interesting thing is that there's supposed to be three distinct types. There's the Dzogchen, which is the big one, you know, 8 to 10 feet tall, dark hair, leaving massive man-like footprints. That's the one we think of when we think of the Yeti. Then there's the Mete, which is more man-sized, has more gingery hair, and it can walk on two legs, but also lope along on all four.
Mm.
And it seems to have a more divergent big toe. Then there's the third type, the Telma, I think I'm pronouncing it right. It's a Telma, which is very like the Orang Pendek. It's but it's very small. It's only about 3 or 4 feet tall, and it lives in the more lowland forest. But all of these creatures are forest animals. You won't get them, you know, lingering above the snow line very long because there's nothing there for them to eat.
Yeah, I mean,
they've got to be supported.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, go on, Richard.
Yeah, I mean, as far back, the pre-Buddhist Himalayan people spoke of this huge, vastly strong, hairy, man-like beast of the forest. They said it would use rocks as weapons and it would make a whistling sound. And all of those things are backed up by modern sightings.
Mm. I think the thing with the Yeti is, Richard, like you've just touched on there, I think the problem we have is that a lot of people, when they've gone looking for the Yeti, they've gone above the snow line, like you say, but common sense would tell us that that's an impossible climate for anything to exist. It's, you know, it's beyond the realms of possibility that any kind of primate could be existing in an environment that harsh. It has to eat, as you refer to. You can't be digging up frozen ground. I mean, what's it going to do? Suck on old grass?
Yeah. And the Russians took all of these things so seriously, they had a commission to look for it. And there's a guy called Boris Prozhnev who wrote about wild men over a huge swathe of Asia. And the Center for 14th Zoology are going to be publishing his book for the first time. There's only ever about 200 or 300 copies done in Russian.
Mm.
And we've got the right to print it for the first time in English. So it's going to be coming out probably next year, the CSZ version, for the first time ever. But I've gone through this book, I've sort of proofed it, and there's lots of sightings never made it to the West that were investigated by the Russians, and it's the first time we're going to be hearing about them. And there's a great one, of a sighting of a huge Yeti from the village of Tarka in Nepal in 1958. And one of the farmers was going to his mill in the morning, and he saw that the door had been opened.
Mm.
And he peered inside, and he said he saw this huge humanoid creature covered with long, thick hair. And he said it was about 3 meters tall, like 10 feet, arms down to the knees, this bold, wrinkled, monkey-like face, and this high conical head, which you hear time and time again, which is a reference to the sagittal crest, like you get on a gorilla.
Yeah.
If you look in gorillas in zoos, they have this high head. And it's to anchor the muscles for powerful jaw muscles. And he said it was eating the flower.
Mm.
It was eating the flower. They'd broken it, it was scuffing the flower, and he went back and got some men from the village, and they were climbing back, and they saw it running off up to the mountain peak. And that sighting has never been, it's one of the ones that has never been in any Western literature, because it was in this Russian book that's completely untranslated.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as cryptids go as well, Richard, I mean, you've mentioned it there. I think if you asked your average person who likes monsters to describe the Yeti, they would describe a extremely large, all-white primate. And I find that, like you say, it's incredible to me because when you look at all the witness reports from the area, nobody, like you say, the majority of them, it's dark brown, black. And yet people all
Sometimes,
over the world think
sometimes,
it's an all-white
right.
creature.
Yeah. So another one of the sightings from this book that's never been spoken about in the West was about a hunter from Chikang Village in the east of the Himalayas in 1968. And he was staying in a cave overnight and made this fire. And he saw two of these things like hurling rocks at him from beyond the fire, and bigger than humans, covered in hair. And they stayed there until dawn and then finally moved away.
I mean, it's a wonderful story as well, and it's so weird how many people have got involved in it. And I spoke to one of the four horsemen, Peter Byrne, about this because I never realised that's how he got into it. He was running a tea plantation in northern India, and heard the stories, and that's what got him into cryptozoology was the fact that the workers were talking about the Yeti. And that's where it came from for him. But once again, that was the same. It was a forest-dwelling creature that was often seen scavenging or breaking into huts, robbing supplies and things, Richard. But it was always described as very dark and very large and very quick.
Yeah, well, the Texas oil millionaire Tom Slick financed a lot of his expeditions, and he himself was told a story of an incident on the road to the Barun Valley in Nepal. And it was by a boy and a girl, and Tom Slick interviewed them separately, and they said they were grazing their herd of yaks at 14,700 feet in the afternoon when a large white animal came out of the bushes and approached them to a distance of about 100 feet. And they said that it was about 10 feet tall, and according to both of them, it was covered with black and brown fur. The head was high and conical, and Slick showed them pictures of various reconstructions of prehistoric men and apes, and you know, and that they said that it had similarities to an orangutan in some ways, but they picked either the prehistoric men or reconstructions of other people's sightings of the Yeti as the thing closest to it. They completely rejected bears and monkeys and other animals, and they said it just disappeared back into the forest. But they found one of the yaks with its neck broken. And these things, you know, they eat plants, but they also take meat as well. They'll grab a yak and twist its neck and break it, or they'll hurl down rocks and crack a yak's skull and carry off the yak and eat it. So they're omnivorous. And a biological twin would really be the brown bear. Anything that a brown bear eats, the Yeti can eat as well.
I mean, that alone
And
is
people who try
staggering,
and
Richard.
Yeah, people who try and say that witnesses are seeing brown bears or you know, the Asian black bear, it's a non-starter. It's like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, because bears have this long snout, they have their ears on the top of their head, which the Yeti doesn't have. It has a flat gorilla-like face with the ears at the side. The Yeti has massive shoulders, whereas the bear, as a quadruped, the scapula, the shoulder blades, lie flush against the side of the animal. They're not sticking out like a human's are, or bipedal creatures are. And bears can't manipulate things. They don't have opposable thumbs. The Yeti can swing a club. It can hurl rocks. Bears can't do that. And when a bear stands on its hind legs, it's a threat posture. And it doesn't stand like that for very long. And there are occasions where there are films of bears running on their hind legs. They run along, but they have these weird little mincing steps, and they look rather silly and clumsy. Not at all like the gait of the Yeti. And this is all just like conveniently ignored skeptics.
Well, this is that goes back to what you were touching on in regards to how the witnesses are sometimes viewed, and the other thing I was going to mention when you touched on that, you know, the disregard for the witnesses, because, you know, what do these people know? That essentially a kind of intellectual snobbery, Richard. It's the same with the Macaulay and Mbembe in Africa, because those people clearly know exactly what's in their environment, and every time they've been tested, they always go towards a dinosaur. But they're always described as being idiots. There is that unspoken disrespect for them because of where they are in the world, I think.
Well, one of the things that interests me, one of the cases that interests me most is of Remy van Leider, who was a Belgian fighter pilot in World War II, decorated, you know, medals and everything. And he became a charter pilot in the Congo, and he was flying over Katanga in the Congo. He goes over a clearing in the jungle, and out of this hole in the ground comes an immense snake. It's dark green, paler underneath, at least 50 feet long, and as the plane went over, it reared up and tried to strike at the plane. And he said the head alone was about 3 feet long by 2 feet wide, very horse-like in shape. And he went back over again, and his photographer snapped a shot of it.
Yeah.
And this is a guy who was a fighter pilot, and he said, I'm used to estimating the size of things from the air. And he was quite low down. This thing was at least 50 foot.
Yeah. I mean, he was quite honest about that when it happened as well, Richard. And I know after he left the Belgian Air Force, he ended up becoming quite a high-ranking government official. So clearly, his experience and his knowledge and his, because he was a decorated war hero as well. He was taken completely seriously, and I know that picture has been analysed, and nobody can say it's not an authentic picture, and they think his dimensions are probably correct. That's terrifying.
What reason has he got to lie? Either he's a charter pilot.
Yeah,
he's going to make up a story of a giant snake. That's going to do nothing for his business.
It's going to ruin you, Richard. We know that too well.
And then there's a case of Bill O'Chee, who was an Australian senator. He was a politician, and this could have killed his career. He came out and said that as a boy, he was one of a number of scouts that had been in this camp in the Australian bush, and they'd seen a Yowie. And he said this thing was huge. It was about 3 metres tall. It was covered in long, shaggy hair. He said it reminded him more than anything than a Chewbacca out of Star Wars, but much more bulky because of this long hair. And they said it was like displaying, like tearing up vegetation and doing this threat display. And the guy that owned the camp seemed very frightened of it, as if he'd seen it before. And they went out, some of them went out to try and find it, and some of them stayed back at the camp. And they said that the thing had doubled round and was following them. And they saw it, I think, over a period of about 2 days. Mm. And when they got back, Bill was going to write this thing up for the school magazine, and the headmaster vetoed it. So he went to the press and told the press about it. Mm. Now, admitting that in later life, when you're a politician, could bloody kill you. Yeah. Kill your career, couldn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the Yowie, and I'm sure you're aware of it, the YouTube channel Dean Harrison runs, the Yowie Hunters.
Yeah.
Some of the witness accounts he has on there, you can hear their voices trembling. It's out of all the cryptids, it seems the one who seems to enjoy terrifying innocent members of the public more than any other, Richard. It really does like to put the willies up people. Mm. It's,
Tony Healy telling me about one case where one of these things looked through the window of a car, and the guy was shitting himself. Absolutely terrified.
Yeah. The witness account for the Yowie that made me think, yeah, there's something in this, was they were interviewing a guy somewhere, I forgot where he lived. He lived down in Queensland somewhere. I can't remember exactly where. And this guy was 6 foot 10. He was a Hell's Angel, Richard. He was massive, and he came face to face with one in his backyard, and his voice was trembling when he was telling the story. And I thought, this guy, I don't think there's any man on earth that would probably intimidate this guy, right? And he was absolutely petrified by this experience. It was incredible listening to him, hear him talk.
Yeah. Well, some people think they use infrasound to frighten people. Because we know that tigers can do that. They can freeze their prey by using very low frequency growls. And it's found that gorillas, recently there's a discovery that gorillas can do it.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of there are well-known examples of creatures using that kind of freeze effect, isn't it?
Sperm whales use sound to stun giant squid.
Yeah.
On a crown giant squid.
Yeah, yeah. It's a remarkable. I think it's just one of those wonderful things, Richard, that we think we know, as we mentioned earlier. Sometimes people seem to think that there's nothing left to discover, but I think the last few years alone have taught us that things seem to be, we seem to be learning new aspects to the animal kingdom in ways that we probably never even considered.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, for decades I've been saying if there's anything in Loch Ness or these other deep lakes like Loch Morar or the Irish Lakes, if there's anything there, it's going to be a huge eel.
Mm.
And what do? They go up there, they do this DNA test on the water, and they find masses and masses and masses of eel DNA.
I mean, it is the strange thing. I'm of the camp that if there are lake monsters, I don't think any exist in this country. However, a giant eel would be monstrous. You know, I'm not disregarding that, saying, you know, it wouldn't be a monster, but in comparison to, say, some of the places in the, you know, in the Great Lakes in America and Canada, I think there's more chance of something odd being out there than there is over here, personally.
Well, a 30-foot eel could have your arm off or your leg off.
Hey,
I was talking to a guy, there was a spate of sightings in Windermere, and we went up to talk to these people in Windermere who'd seen various things. I mean, one of the witnesses, it sounded like he'd seen a swimming deer. Another one sounded like a Wells catfish, but others sounded like very big eels. And one guy we talked to on the way up, the guy in Manchester, and his name was Mark, and he said all the way back in 1959, he had seen one of these things, and he said he was 19 at the time, and every year they'd go on a sailing trip, him and his mates, to Lake Windermere, and they'd sail, take a sailing boat along Lake Windermere, and they'd done it many times. And he said this particular time, 1959, something drew up against the boat and they all saw it, and they said they couldn't see the head and they couldn't see the end of the tail, they just saw the midsection of it, and they said it was like tubular, greenish grey with a texture like old weather-beaten leather, old wrinkled leather like you get on an old sofa, and they said it was moving side to side, and his description was of a huge eel. And he said when he got to the campsite, they asked the guy at the campsite, have you got anything like the Loch Ness Monster living in here? And the guy gave him such a look that he said none of them ever mentioned it again until all those years later. And there were all these new sightings.
Yeah.
And this guy, he was just like matter-of-factly, and he says, I've never told anybody after that because people thought I was an idiot until all these new sightings came out.
Yeah.
And this guy, he's got nothing to grind. He's gaining nothing from it.
Mm.
And there's loads of sightings in Ireland of these things. There's sightings of them crawling across the land, these huge eels. One of the most intriguing, it comes from a place called Drewster House in County Meath in Ireland. And it was owned by a family called the McVeighs. And in 1907, Major McVeigh, who'd been serving in India, he came home on leave. And there had been some feral dogs that had been killing sheep. So the shepherd had laid some poison down and killed these two dogs. And Major McVeigh left the carcasses by the side of this lake on the Drewston estate. And the locals would never go near these lakes because they thought they were monsters in them. Pardon me. And Major McVeigh got up in the morning, intending to get rid of these two dogs. Went down there, found that the dogs had gone, but there were two massive dead eels on the side of this lake. Had obviously eaten the carcasses and got killed by the poison. And they hauled them out. One of them was 12 foot long and one was 10 foot long. Now, the European eel is usually about 3 foot long.
Yeah.
And they photograph these things on in front of Drewston House on the steps, and they have got these pillars and steps. And apparently this photograph was framed and kept at Drewston House, and Major McVeigh, you know, kept it in his living room, and he'd take it down to the pub, down to the local pub, if anybody disbelieved him.
Yeah.
If anyone said you're a liar, he'd take this...
Mm.
But they emigrated to Australia, the McVeigh family, and it's now a missionary training centre, Drewston House.
Mm.
And I contacted the guy that runs it now, and he says, I've heard the story, but I've never seen the photograph, and I don't know what's happened to it. So I'm currently trying to get a hold of it, and I'm you know, asking expat communities in Australia, you know, if they know anybody called McVeigh, who are Irish expats, they might have this photograph and not realise just how important it is.
Yeah.
You know, just how, what an amazing piece of scientific evidence it might be.
Absolutely. It'd be gathering dust in somebody's attic, hopefully, Richard.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean
yeah,
it's, the... eels are vicious creatures as well, Richard. It wouldn't
oh, good
surprise
Lord, yeah.
me. I mean, there are numerous, you know, I wouldn't recommend watching some of them, but there are numerous videos where people come a cropper when they meet, you know, eels that are about between 10 and 8 feet long, and they go, I'm not bothered out, you know, these are 6 foot divers, these are experienced people, they don't care, they'll have a go.
Yeah. 2004, there was a Canadian tourist who say that they saw an eel in the shallows at Loch Ness that was about 25 feet long.
Yeah.
It makes more sense than a surviving plesiosaur.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course. And like you say, I think the one thing a lot of people don't realise about eels is that they can come ashore if they fancy it.
Yeah, they can move for miles across land.
There are several species. I mean, catfish are one of them. There's a Chinese, what is it, a snakehead? And they are renowned for just getting up and walking to the nearest. They can smell fresh water supplies. And America is unfortunately suffering another infestation of these creatures where it's a basically kill on sight policy for those. Horrible things.
Yeah, but they've got one hell of a bite on them as well.
Mm. Yeah. So, what's next for you, Richard? What's in the pipeline? Obviously, you released your latest book in May this year. So I hope that's continued to do well for you this year.
Yeah. My new book is out, which is called Adventures in Cryptozoology Volume 1.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be a single volume, but there was too much of it, so it had to be split into two volumes. Volume 2 is out next autumn, in about a year's time. But Volume 1, you can get it from Amazon, Adventures in Cryptozoology. That's got lots of information on lake and sea serpents and mystery apes and other primates and other types of strange creature around the world. And in the second volume, I'll be looking at possible surviving creatures that were thought to be extinct, like the Tasmanian wolf and other things as well, and giant creatures like huge crocodiles and the giant anaconda, which of course is an infamous creature from South America. And I've been over there looking for that, the giant anaconda, and I've heard, you know, I heard a story from a tribal chief, our guide over there, Damon Corey, is an Arawak clan tribal chief, and he said some of the hunters told him a story of an anaconda so vast that they ran away from it in a place called Corona Falls. And when he asked them how long it was, they pointed to a fallen tree, and they said it was crawling over a dead tree like that, and its head protruded over one end and its tail over the other, so it was well over 40 feet long. And there are stories of anaconda in the depths of the Amazon, anywhere from 40 to 60 feet. That's a tube of muscle. 60 feet long with teeth at one end. And because they live in water and they don't lay eggs, the females give birth to live young. They've broken this link with the land so they can stay in water, buoyed up, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And if they're undisturbed in the right areas, they could get immensely big. But the gauchos used to call them the manatora, the bull killer, because they said they would drag down full-grown bulls and horses and constrict them and swallow them whole. So that's one of the things I'm kind of covering in Volume 2, but Volume 1 covers things like the Yeti and modern-day sightings of dragon-like creatures and the Orang Pen Dek and things like the Beast of Jadavan, all sorts of things. But it's Adventures in Cryptozoology Volume 1 is out now. And of course, the Mongolian Death Worm, which is a creature I went hunting for back in 2005. I went for 1,000 miles through the deserts of the Gobi on a trail of the Mongolian Death Worm, talked to about 2 dozen witnesses and the nomads who fear the creature so much that if they see it, they'll pack up all their animals and their gears, the circular tents they have, and just move out of the area. It can throw a whole area into a panic. And they describe this thing like a salami or a grass excluder, sort of a scaly, brick red, tubular creature. It's probably a reptile, probably a burrowing reptile, like a worm lizard, rather than a true worm, but they are petrified of it. And I'm hopefully back over there next year for another crack at the old death worm. back to the Dobie to see if I can find one and maybe capture one, because the death worm, the size that it is, it's the sort of thing that you could possibly capture and bring back to Ulaanbaatar, the capital. It's not like trying to catch a 10-foot yeti or a 60-foot anaconda. You could get hold of the death worm and bring it back. Also, I've got some sponsorship next year. I've got a lady who wants to sponsor an expedition next year, so I'm going to be talking to her. So it will depend on, how much she wants to give me as to where we want to go, but the number of places I'm thinking of. There's a place called Lake Chany in Siberia, where some creature in the lake has supposedly killed 14 people over the last decade or so. It's been ramming boats, overturning boats and grabbing people, maybe a gigantic eel. And there are other lakes in Siberia with similar stories. Lake Verota and Lake Lavanika have these similar stories of this thing that will flip over rafts and boats and grab people. But the people at Lake Chany have asked for an official government investigation. And the government line is people are just getting drunk and drowning. But there are witnesses who've seen this thing ram boats and grab people, and bits of them wash up having been masticated by whatever it was.
Delightful.
It sounds like a horror movie.
That's Lake Placid.
for a horror movie, but it's happening in this lake in Siberia, and no one's going to investigate.
There are
several cases of giant crocodiles around the world. There's one in New Guinea along the Sepik River, which is held sacred by the tribe in the area, that's supposed to be at least 30 feet long. And at that size, it's going to be weighing 3 or 4 tons.
Yeah.
This is an animal with a bite, 3 times more powerful than a great white. There's another one in eastern India, in Orissa in eastern India. And then there's another one in the Philippines called Potol that lives in the Busan Marsh, that's supposed to be 30 feet long, and a known man-eater. And I'd love to go and try and get those things on a film, but it's all down to the green folding stuff at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've tried so hard to get television interested in these sort of things, and you'd think they'd be all over it.
Yeah.
Now think about it. If you just take those crocodiles, if you did a series, and of course there's Gustav in Lake Tanganyika in Africa, he's at least 23 feet, a Nile crocodile that's supposed to have eaten 300 people. How about a series where you go around the world trying to film the biggest crocodile in the world, all these semi-legendary giant crocs that, are either held in utter terror, that people are terrified of them, or they sort of venerate them as divine creatures. What an exciting series that would make.
Absolutely.
No one's interested. Nobody wants to know.
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing
the Lake Chany thing.
Yeah.
The Lake Chany thing. It runs like the script to a goddamn horror film.
Yeah.
Go over there, interview the witnesses, the people that have seen people getting devoured, their relatives, and you go out, use underwater cameras, bait, go out on a boat,
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are certain channels it would be better to do something like that, Richard, than a 2-hour fake documentary on mermaids, shall we say?
Yeah. Yeah, or a 2-hour fake documentary on surviving Carcharodon megalodons.
Yeah, I mean, it's as you were referring to there in regards to, I remember seeing the documentary about when they caught Lolong, and the thing that struck me about that was right at the end when they were interviewing the local people. I mean, how they, the way they live, it's just incredible, because they live on these water houses where basically your front door is the river.
Yeah.
It's mind blowing to know that there are these crocodiles, because he was just having a nice little swim up and down here and picking people off. And when they caught him, they said, oh, yeah, you've got that one, but the bigger one's still here. And I thought, what?
Yes, Pothole is the bigger one.
Yeah.
No Long was just over 20 feet.
Yes.
And Pothole is 30 feet.
Lolong alone was just incredible to see that creature. It was mesmerizing,
yeah.
Richard. So, I mean, and I remember seeing a program about Gustav, and good Lord. That's not a situation I would ever want to be in, is to come face to face with him.
I mean, one of the park wardens saw him attack and kill a full grown hippo.
Good Lord. I mean,
so imagine what he could do to a boat.
Yeah, well, the hippo is is one of the, it's a pub quiz question. You know, it's the most dangerous animal in Africa. Everybody always says, you know, compared to, you know, mosquitoes and snakes, I'm sure kill more, but it's probably the creature that most people don't realise is as dangerous as it is, Richard. I've heard some horrific stories of people coming face to face with hippos, and for something to be able to take one of them down, that's some doing.
Yeah, I mean, there are very few things that could take out a hippo. A white rhinoceros would be able to gore one to death, or an elephant, but apart from that, but this crocodile is so massive, apparently it just tore the throat from the hippo.
Deary me. Well, I think that should terrify everybody enough that we should leave it there, Richard. I think.
Yeah.
So where can everybody keep up to date with what you're up to and things, Richard? As you've mentioned, the book's available on Amazon, isn't it, the latest one?
Yeah, the website is the Centre for Fortean Zoology. That's www.cfz.org.uk. I'm on richard@cfz.org.uk. That's my, if anyone wants to ask questions, that's my email. I'm always looking for sponsorship, any of these things, if anybody out there fancies sponsoring an expedition. And as I say, if you want to buy my book, all the money goes, is, you know, siphoned back into the next monster hunt. So that's Adventures in Cryptozoology, Volume 1. You can get it on Amazon, and you can order it from most of bookshops, and probably most crap bookshops as well.
Brilliant. Well, listen, Richard, it's been an absolute pleasure as always. Thank you for coming back, and keep
Cheers,
us updated, mate. And let us know about the expeditions, and fingers crossed, you get gone
okay.
Somewhere, and wherever you go, I will be delighted to have you back on to tell us all about it.
Cheers, mate. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Take care, Richard. Bye-bye.
Cheers, mate. Bye-bye.